Chapter 7. The Mysterious Message. I will be with you 2 weeks longer, said Saint Germain, as soon as we had returned to our hotel. With your permission, I will devote a part of each day to individual instruction, which I can see with the inner unlimited sight you are going to need. Our interference with the plans of the Senator Forrest and the imprisonment of their tools that took place in Washington recently has drawn the attention of certain forces to you, especially to Gaylord and this brother, indicating me. You both have certain faculties developed in former lives which can be used in many remarkable ways. It is because of this that the Senator Force will try to strike at you. However, you will be protected in every way and kept perfectly safe, so long as you keep poised and free from anger, hate, or fear. This is why I wish to give you certain definite training along the line of self-protection. The most important and imperative thing for you to remember always is to fully accept and realize that the mighty I Am Presence is the magic presence, and that it is focused in, through, and around you at all times. You have seen your glorious God-self of dazzling light, the very life of your own being, while you were at the ranch, so there is no excuse for not accepting it completely. The outer activity of your mind is the bucking bronco. This you must bring under subjection and make it perfectly obedient to the mighty I Am Presence in every way. For those who have not been privileged to see the God-self, there might be some excuse, although it is speaking constantly through the heart to every human being that ever was born into this world. But after an individual has once seen his perfect self, the blazing God-light, there is no reason for ignoring that presence afterwards. When its form and light have once been recorded in the outer activity of the mind through the sight, the individual can at any instant recall that picture, consciously and at will, and again release that power into all earthly problems. The sincere student can draw the full power of the mighty I Am Presence into any condition, and so charge all things with perfection. Thus, he can live once again in the Father's house, in the glorious freedom that was originally designed for him. This is the only predestination there is. Having once seen your mighty I Am Presence, your own vision is one of the most powerful faculties you have for bringing invisible activity into visible physical form. The architects of your business world are doing this constantly. They receive an idea, which is an invisible activity, and then draw a picture of it. It is but a very short time until the substance is drawn together and the invisible idea has become a visible, tangible building. The individual's ability to use this law is absolutely unlimited, but it is only when the student consciously sets to work to control his faculty of sight so that he closes it to the picturing of negative conditions that he begins to have freedom and puts his world in order. The average person's thoughts and feelings are nothing but a mass of chaotic pictures and negative suggestions, which he has accepted from the world about him and keeps repeating and feeding them by his own energy through his attention. Order is heaven's first law, harmony and peace the cohesive power of the universe. These come from one source only, and that is the mighty I Am Presence of the universe, your God-self. Limitless substance and invincible power are forever about you. You have only to understand how to raise or lower the atomic vibratory action by the power of the I Am in order to produce whatsoever you can possibly desire. There is no one to say what shall come into your experience and world but yourself. The limitless, omnipresent substance is always about you, waiting to be acted upon. You, the individual, are the channel through which the mighty I Am Presence wishes to expand its perfection. It pours out ceaselessly the limitless light or energy of life, but you are the governor of its use, the director of its destination and of the result it is to bring forth for you. It can and will produce anything you wish instantly, if you will but keep your personality harmonized so that thoughts, feelings, and words of discord do not interrupt its ever-flowing perfection. Life is perfection, and it contains all perfect manifestation within itself. The only duty of the personality is to be a cup that carries and reveals the perfection of life. Until one obtains obedience from the outer senses and maintains a feeling of peace within himself, he pollutes the purity and perfection of the life that is flowing through. It is your duty to know that the wisdom of the mighty I Am Presence always directs your use of its power and life. It alone knows what is perfect for you, except an ascended master. He, being one with the all-knowing mind of God, is one with your I Am Presence, no matter whether it acts through you or through him. Thus, only your own I Am Presence or an ascended master knows what is right for you at all times. Only these two sources, which are really one, can see down your entire life stream and know all the forces that play upon your problems and the cause of your experiences, past, present, and future. The lack of discrimination in distinguishing the true from the false is the thing that makes mankind fail everywhere in the outer world. The one who determines to attain perfection must train the outer activity of his mind to listen to no voice but that of his mighty I Am Presence. He must accept only its wisdom and obey only its direction. He must hear the light, see the light, feel the light, and be the light of the infinite I Am Presence. While there is a different individualization or flame of God governing each human body, yet these individualizations are, have, and use the one universal mind, substance, wisdom, and power. This is how there is but one mind, one God, one substance, and one power, ever waiting to be consciously acted upon and directed by the mighty I Am Presence through the conscious mind or outer activity of the individual. If the feeling and thought of the personality is kept harmonious, then the mighty I Am Presence expands its perfection through the outer activity of the individual. If they be discordant, the personality becomes like a steam engine without a governor and destroys itself. The latter is the condition the larger part of humanity is expressing today. Everyone is constantly using this wonderful, limitless energy, the greatest force in the universe. The responsibility for its use rests entirely upon the individual, for he is a creator. If this tremendous energy be used with the conscious understanding of love, wisdom, and power of the mighty I Am Presence, the individual can only express freedom, perfection, and mastery. We all know that there are thousands who desire this instruction. That is true. But no individual in heaven or on earth can fail to attain it if the desire for the light be earnest enough, determined enough, and strong enough to hold the attention of the intellect upon that light. This must be the paramount idea of life upon which to focus all one's energy. To the one who has this great determination, undreamed of ways will open to bring about the fulfillment of that desire. If human beings seek the light with one eye and the pleasure of the senses with the other, they will not receive much light. The great ascended masters have become perfect and all-powerful by dwelling or thinking upon perfection and obeying the one law of life, love. They are that upon which they have meditated. Today, mankind is that upon which it has meditated or focused its attention in the past. Human beings would not live to be over 12 years of age if it were not for the continual help of these great luminous beings of transcendent attainment and love. They give the same wonderful care to the inhabitants of earth that loving, unselfish parents give to their children, and help all individuals who have a sincere desire to live constructively. To such persons, an opportunity is always open that they may attune to and contact the mighty I Am Presence within themselves, anchor to perfection, and thus come into the ascended state also, if they be determined enough. The ascended masters always work in perfect cooperation with the cosmic law of love. Students often ask, why, if these masters are all-wise and all-powerful, do they not correct the discord upon earth and make humanity's suffering cease? They do help the individual who wishes to serve the light to harmonize his thought and feeling and bring the body into obedience to the mighty I Am Presence. They protect him thousands of times from destructive currents of force and activities of which he has no knowledge. But they cannot and do not fulfill his plan of life for him. Each individual knows a thing only when he attains the consciousness of it by the expenditure of his own energy, for then he feels it. An ascended master never, never intrudes upon the eternal sacred prerogative of the individual's free will. Whenever a destructive force of any kind gathers a certain momentum or accumulates pressure, whether it be done by an individual, a group of individuals, a nation, or in nature, the great cosmic law allows it to spend its force in order to annihilate the focus, balance the pressure, and release the misqualified energy back into the universal reservoir. There it becomes purified by the great flame of life and can be used again. The personality, if it be obedient, can by the conscious command of the I Am Presence release the consuming flame of divine love and willingly purify its own miscreation. Thus the individual avoids the necessity for compulsory balancing and purification by the action of cosmic law. The willingness to right a wrong, correct a mistake, balance and purify any miscreation will always open the way for an ascended master to give assistance and bring permanent attainment. This willingness can come in a group, a nation, or an entire humanity, just as well as it can in the individual. For the infinite only acts and controls the universe through its own individualization, through the being who says, I am. Creation could never have taken place if the infinite had not acknowledged its own being through the individual, I am. When the individual determines to express the perfection of life, he must be loyal enough to his own I Am Presence to stand back of his own decree in the face of all outer experience. He can then give the great command, and life yields to him the fullness of every good thing, so long as the mighty I Am Presence is acknowledged as the owner and doer of all that is good. If one refuses to accept his I Am Presence, he refuses all good and the source that gives it. As life is the great God flame from which all proceeds, he, by this attitude of thought and feeling, refuses life. Hence, disintegration is the self-chosen experience, which the individual permits the outer activity of his consciousness to impose upon his own stream of life. If thoughts and feelings of anger, hate, selfishness, criticism, condemnation, and doubt of the I Am Presence are permitted to remain in the consciousness of any human being, the door to perfection closes, and his existence becomes but a process of sleeping and eating until the energy drawn by the outer consciousness spends itself and the body is left to dissolution. Then the individual makes another effort to express the fullness of perfection through another body and continues this effort for aeons if necessary, until that perfection is fully expressed. It is to avoid such continual re-embodiment into limitation that it is so imperative for the individual to have conscious understanding of the purpose of life, because the knowledge of how to release love, wisdom, and power enables him to fulfill that purpose perfectly. I can assist you to attain this, because by the use of the consuming flame of divine love, for the purifying and blessing of humanity, you can always free yourself. I am delighted with Bob's progress. It is a long time since I have contacted anyone with such determination and whose desire for attainment is so intense. His advancement is truly wonderful. I have tickets to the opera of Parsifal tonight, he continued, changing the subject abruptly. Will you be my guests? That evening, in his wonderful presence, Parsifal became something far more than an opera. It was the struggle of the individual through human embodiment. The instruction he poured out to us as the drama of the soul and the victory of the I Am Presence unfolded itself in music and allegory was one of the most marvelous experiences I have ever had. As the performance began, he said, "Observe what can be done for those who are sincere and loyal to the highest ideals through their art." The two who play the part of Parsifal and Kundry were the fortunate ones chosen for this remarkable blessing. They had been singing a short time when Saint Germain turned on a great stream of spiritual power, and instantly one could detect the change in their voices. They became more remarkable in quality. The timbre increased so powerfully that the singers themselves were visibly delighted and amazed. One could feel the charge of electronic light penetrate everything. The audience felt the change too, thrilled with delight and enthusiasm, and called them back again and again in its appreciation. What will be the result, I asked, at the first opportunity, when they find their voices are not the same the next time they wish to sing? This added power and perfection will be permanent, he replied. Former growth permits it to be done for them at this present time. If they had not made previous effort, it would not have been permissible to use them in order to give you this instruction. The beloved sister and brother will think that divine providence has come to their assistance, which is literally true. Only in this case, I happen to be the director of providence. As scene after scene was presented that night, Saint Germain showed us the true meaning of what was being portrayed in a manner we can never forget. By the time it came to a close, I was raised to a tremendous spiritual height, and the exaltation was so great that it lasted for hours. We returned to our hotel, filled with unspeakable joy and gratitude. The following 2 weeks passed rapidly while our instruction continued. Then one morning our beloved master announced that he was leaving us for a time and that he had retained his suite of rooms for the use of Nara, Pearl, Rex, and Bob over the holidays. Bidding us a loving goodbye, he disappeared. Next morning, Gaylord came to me with a letter which he had found on the table in his room, requesting that he come to a certain address in New York at once. He seemed concerned about it, and yet he sensed an uncertainty, something that was not altogether as it should be. I don't understand how the letter got on my table without going through the mail, he explained. I have inquired, and no one seems to know who placed it there. As he continued to ponder over it, there increased within me a sense of uneasiness. I said so frankly, but his only remark was, "I must go and find out what it means and shall leave by the next train." I wanted to accompany him, but he explained it was not necessary, so I determined to follow my own inner direction. As soon as he had gone, Raybor and I discussed it, and I decided to follow him. "I am leaving at once by airplane," I said. "He will be in great danger, I feel certain. And why he has not sensed it himself, I do not know. At any rate, I shall watch events, and may call you by telephone." Fortunately, I had noticed the address in Gaylord's letter, and hastened at once to the flying field, where a plane left immediately, reaching New York long before he arrived. I went to the address, looked the place over thoroughly, but saw no sign of anything unusual. At last, I saw Gaylord get out of a taxi and enter the building. The place was a high-class apartment hotel, and as he inquired for the number, I heard the man at the desk say they are on the 10th floor. I followed and kept well out of sight. The door to the apartment opened and a beautiful woman admitted him. I waited a long time, but he did not come out. At last I was about to go to the door when it opened, and two tall, fine-looking men and the beautiful woman with Gaylord came out. They went down to the lobby, passed quickly through, and entered a waiting auto. I saw Gaylord was very pale, but poised and calm. They drove rapidly away. I jumped into a taxi and followed, giving the driver orders to keep them in sight. Their car arrived at a pier from which a transatlantic liner was sailing. They went aboard at once. I made inquiries and found that the boat was to leave at 10 o'clock for Cherbourg. I was positive by this time that Gaylord was being forced to accompany them, so I went direct to the transportation office, and after considerable argument and tipping, finally secured passage. I wired Rayburn of my sailing and sent a letter explaining. I provided myself with a grip and clothing, boarding the steamer at 9:30. I asked the magic I am presence to see that my stateroom was near Gaylord's. Not knowing the name under which these people traveled, I secured a passenger list and asked the I am presence to show me which staterooms they were in. My attention became focused upon four names, and the inner light corroborated my feeling. I looked up the location and discovered that one of them adjoined mine. I made it my business to watch and listen, and was rewarded the second morning about 4 o'clock by hearing voices, and among them at intervals Gaylord's, in an undertone, just barely audible. I put my ear close to the wall, and using all the power of the I am, so that I might miss nothing, and be able to give him assistance if necessary. There was evidently some argument, and very determined pressure was being brought to bear upon him in several ways, for at last I heard his voice raised to a pitch that indicated he was giving an ultimatum that did not work to their advantage. At last, he spoke so loud that anyone passing outside could hear him. "No," he was saying, "I will not intercede for your accomplices, even if you kill me." "We shall see," replied a man's deep voice, "when we get you in the hands of our assistants in Paris." In those few words enough was revealed to show they were trying to force the release of the others who had just been seized in Washington. I sent a wireless to Rayburn to be silent and wait, that I had learned the necessary details. Then, in the quiet of my room, I sent a message to Saint Germain and the Brotherhood, that some of them might meet me when we landed at Cherbourg. I was not conscious of any answer, but I felt at ease and peace after the effort, and rested in that feeling of accomplishment. It was then 5 o'clock in the morning, and I lay down to get a few hours' rest, for I knew I would need all the alertness and strength possible. While sleeping, I dreamed, or I thought so, at the time, that I met the master of whom Gaylord had told me many wonderful things, he who had been sent by the Brotherhood to take him on his first trip to the Himalayas. He said to me distinctly, "Be at peace, my brother. I will meet you when the boat lands at Cherbourg. All is ready, and the control of this situation is in the hands of those who never fail." I saw him so clearly in the experience that I felt sure I would know him anywhere. The whole experience was too real and tangible to be a dream, and I knew that I must have gone to him in my higher mental body while the other body slept. I awakened later, wonderfully refreshed. All that day, I kept close watch of their staterooms, but learned nothing. I got up at 4 the next morning, and at 5 was rewarded by seeing the 2 men come out. I saw them very plainly, so I was certain I would recognize them again anywhere. They walked the deck for a while and returned. The woman left the stateroom and took her turn at exercising in the fresh air. I had hoped they would all go out at one time, but they were too shrewd and kept Gaylord very closely guarded. The 4th day was very stormy, and I saw no one. That night, I spent listening intensely every moment, hoping for some kind of revelation. Finally, at midnight, they argued with Gaylord again, but he was adamant. They told him where they would take him, and I noted the address carefully. It was strange they did not seem to suspect that someone might follow them, except that they kept strictly to themselves during the entire trip. The 5th morning, the woman came out to walk on deck a short time, and during that interval I heard the men discussing her. She was evidently an American, and socially prominent in Paris. As near as I could judge from their conversation, she was under their influence, and through her they were avoiding any suspicion being directed to themselves. I realized there was no opportunity of reaching Gaylord without endangering the whole matter, so I trusted to my inner feeling and relied upon the Brotherhood and Saint Germain to guide me further. I thought the masked ball during our last night on board might draw them into association with the rest of the passengers, but nothing induced them to come out of their seclusion. The last night was a brilliant social affair. The next morning I was up at 4 o'clock, but nobody left the stateroom until we came alongside the pier. As our steamer docked, they all came out together. I did not dare to let Gaylord see me, lest we betray ourselves, but I felt help was near at hand and followed them as closely as I could. They hurried away from the pier, and my heart began to sink when a hand touched my shoulder. As I looked up, the master of my dreams stood before me. "Come quickly," he said. "I will explain as we go." We followed the others rapidly and kept them in sight until they entered an auto. At that moment a car drew alongside of us, and the master motioned me to enter. We drove along rapidly, keeping the other car clearly in sight. "I am Gaylord's friend, of whom he told you," he continued while we sped along. "I received your message, and also one from him shortly after." He introduced himself and requested that I never reveal his name. "My son, you are a true brother of the great white brotherhood, and out of this experience will come good of which you do not now dream." There were many other cars on the road, so it was an easy matter to keep them in sight without attracting attention. They drove at a normal speed, and we soon reached the outskirts of Paris. A few moments later, a large car came alongside of us. The master opened our door as the two cars stopped, and a man stepped from that machine into ours, while his car turned at the next corner and disappeared. As he sat down, the master explained, "This is another brother of the light, who will stay on guard when Gaylord reaches his destination." At last, their car came to a large villa, with beautiful grounds surrounding it, but the building was falling into ruins. As we saw them pull up in front of this place, we stopped in a secluded spot. They went into the building, and their machine drove rapidly away. The Brother of Light got out of our car to observe. "Watch every move," the master said to him. "You know where and how to reach me. I will take this brother where he can have peace and rest. He needs it very much. I give you my blessing. May the magic presence seal you in its ray." Then, speaking to our driver in a language I did not understand, we drove away at a speed which I did not believe was ever allowed in any city. These two men who have Gaylord in charge, the master explained further, are to wait there for five of their accomplices, two of whom are on their way from Russia. This group cabled from New York that they would arrive today, and those from Russia will be here the day after tomorrow. Our car soon came to a beautiful villa, and as we stepped out, the most delightful fragrance of roses filled the air. We entered the house and were greeted by a beautiful young lady, the sister of the master who had brought me. As I thought how very young she looked, he smiled. "My sister is much older than she looks," he volunteered. "My good brother, my sister, and I have both lived far beyond the allotted 80 years. Our understanding has enabled us to utilize certain laws, direct and maintain certain currents of energy in the body, erase all signs of age, and remain eternally youthful and beautiful. I have retained this body for 310 years, and my sister for 300. You see, from the human standpoint, we should have passed through the change called death long ago. But that reaper has no terrors for us. It can never touch us now. We have had the benefit of the atomic accelerator in the Cave of Symbols in your beloved America. You are surprised that we have been there? Why? We saw you and your friends in that marvelous retreat quite recently. The joy and marvelous love your hearts sent forth was one of the most beautiful and encouraging experiences we have had in many years. In the near future, we shall be there again to complete the raising of these bodies into that eternally perfect state of the ascended masters. Then we can come and go freely as they do and work above all limitation. Of course, you understand that after having been given the benefit of the wonderful accelerator, it is imperative that the student maintain always a constant state of conscious harmony, no matter what the condition may be within or about him. Once this assistance has been given to the outer self, it must keep that power flowing through the body from the mighty I Am Presence. To some students this is quite a struggle, but it will be short if one has real determination to hold to the great light. Come, we are forgetting the joy of hospitality. I will show you to your room, and as soon as you have refreshed yourself, we shall dine. He showed me to an exquisite room and bath, and I could not help but notice how these great ones, who are the carriers of the light, always are surrounded by beauty, harmony, and perfection in every part of their special activity. I remarked about this once to Saint Germain, and he replied, "When life is lived as it was intended, all is peace, harmony, beauty, opulence, and happiness. To conquer the desire to feel or express inharmony shuts the door to inharmony. Therefore, it cannot act within the personal self nor its environment. It is a joy to know that humanity has the strength to do this and thus receive the untold blessings of life." We had dinner, and the master urged me to go to my room to sleep until called. I obeyed and was awakened at 7 o'clock in the morning by sweet chimes sounding through my room. They thrilled my body, as if a charge of electronic energy had come through the sound. I dressed quickly and joined the master and his sister in the drawing room. I felt so wonderful it seemed as if there were no such thing as being weary. Much had taken place during my rest. Word had been received that the tools of the Sinister Force were arriving to join their accomplices the following day. All must be in readiness to act quickly, the master explained. The Brothers of Light, who are members of the French Secret Service, have been instructed to be thoroughly prepared, and that there must be no publicity about the seizure of this group. You can imagine my joy when, 2 days later, as I entered the drawing room, Saint Germain greeted me serenely and as graciously as usual. A moment later, as the master and his sister entered, a dazzling light flashed through the room. "Come," said Saint Germain, "all is ready. Let us go." As we approached the rendezvous, there was not a movement or sound. Saint Germain went up to the door, extended his hand. The lock clicked, and the door opened noiselessly. He led the way, as though familiar with every detail. He approached massive double doors and again extended his hand. They fairly flew open, so great was the force he had focused. Before us stood the seven tools, Gaylord, and the woman. As we entered, the seven drew weapons, and for a fraction of a second, the battle was one of mental forces. Suddenly, a circle of blue flame surrounded them. Their hands dropped to their sides, and the brothers of the Secret Service entered. In less than another minute, the tools were in handcuffs, within closed autos, and on their way to a certain place of restraint, where no other prisoners can ever contact them. Gaylord was surprised and overjoyed at the speed and quiet with which his release and their capture had come about. They had tried to force him to use certain legal authority that was his to have their co-workers in America released. "Beloved brothers," he said, "I can never thank you enough for saving this body for further service." They were deeply in earnest, I can assure you, and would have destroyed me when I refused to help them. However, in their unguarded conversation, I learned much that will be of value to us in the future. He embraced each of us with great tenderness, love, and gratitude. "The woman was guarded by us," Saint Germain explained. "It is not necessary to punish this child. She has been but an innocent victim of their villainous treachery." "My dear sister," he said, "we do not wish to harm you. You have been but the plaything of this sinister force. You shall have complete release and freedom forever from its influence and control." Instantly, a blue spiral flame encircled her from head to foot. Her body swayed as if she would have fallen to the floor, and yet could not, because she was held in the embrace of its marvelous power. She stood thus, fully 10 minutes, and then the flame slowly faded out. Her body trembled violently a moment, and her eyes opened with a pleading, appealing expression. "Oh, where am I?" she asked. "You are with friends," Saint Germain replied, as he took her hand in his. "You are forever released from a condition far worse than death. Come, and we shall take you home." "No, no," she replied frantically. "I can never go home again after all I have done and all that has happened. I cannot, I cannot." "Yes, you can," Saint Germain answered, with a conviction and power of the truth that changed all resistance into instant obedience. "You will find everything changed, for your good husband understands and will welcome you home. Your daughter, an invalid who has suffered so much, shall also be restored, and your home will be a happy, wonderful place once again." We went out, entered the car of Gaylord's friend, and drove to a beautiful residence in the best residential section of Paris. We entered and were received by a tall, slender man whom I knew instantly to be an American. He had been handsome in earlier years, but now his face showed deep lines of care and sorrow. With tears streaming down his face, he held out his arms to his wife. She rushed into them, sobbing as though her heart would break. Saint Germain waited a moment, and when she became calm, presented us to him. "Beloved friends," he said, "let us go to your lovely daughter, for we have further work to do." We entered a lovely room where a girl, once beautiful, lay upon the bed, so drawn and deformed that she hardly seemed human. Saint Germain stepped to the bedside, took her left hand in his, placed the thumb of his right hand on her forehead between the eyes. He stood in this position for about 5 minutes, while the rest of us looked on expectantly. Suddenly, The girl gave the most unearthly scream. Her whole body straightened out on the bed, and she lay as still as if in death. "Have no fear," he said. "She will be conscious in a few moments. Then I will give her strength to stand and walk." Presently, she opened her eyes with the sweetest smile of love and gratitude, and the light of her I Am presence streamed out in blessing to Saint Germain. He extended his hand, assisting her to rise and stand on her feet, while she received the loving embrace of her father and mother. Saint Germain picked the child up and carried her to a soft couch in the drawing room. He gave directions for her care and said he would be with them the following day. We returned to the home of our wonderful friend, and a full explanation was given to Gaylord of all that had happened since he had left Washington. His gratitude was very great, and he discussed his own feeling and reaction during the trip on the boat. "The only feeling I had during the entire experience," he explained, "was to trust wholly in my mighty I Am presence and the great white brotherhood." "My beloved students and brothers," said Saint Germain, "do you not see how unfailingly the great law of God acts? In this case, the sinister force tried to compel a member of the great white brotherhood to serve it, and therefore darkness. You see, our good brother became the decoy and his light, the channel by which seven more of their destructive talons were cut off from any further activity, and a very great joy and happiness was restored to a wonderful, blessed family. I have news that will surprise you still further. The man to whom his lovely wife and daughter were this day restored is Arthur Livingston, the uncle of our beloved brother, Bob Singleton. This man is the most highly inspired mining engineer I know. I mean by that, he is well directed by the mighty I Am presence in his mining work. I wish all three of them to return to America with you, for you will find they will become very earnest fellow students. Tomorrow, I will arrange a return passage for you, but during the next week, you are to remain in Paris until your boat sails. During that time, we were the guests of Gaylord's wonderful friend and his sister. The next day, we accompanied Saint Germain to the Livingstons. When we entered, the transformation was greater than the human mind believes possible. Mr. Livingston looked 10 years younger. The daughter was radiantly beautiful and happy, gaining strength and the normal use of her body with amazing ease and rapidity. The mother's wonderful love was now fully reawakened, and her devotion to her family was very great. She wanted so much to make amends for all the suffering that had come to them through her. "This suffering," she said to us, "that so nearly wrecked everything for myself and my family, was the result of my desire for social supremacy wherever we had lived. As I look upon the whole experience now, I can see that my desire for social influence was an intense craving that completely absorbed all my time and attention. Very nearly did irreparable damage to us all. I promise you, I shall never forget this lesson. I shall try to make amends for it all by greater devotion to my family and eternal service to the light." "I wish the three of you," said Saint Germain, addressing the Livingstons, "to sail with these friends to America, where I desire you to make your permanent home. It will help you to forget the experiences that have caused so much suffering here." Their joy was unspeakable, and their gratitude to him is everlasting. A week later, when we said goodbye to Saint Germain, Gaylord's friend and his sister, we could not find words to express what was in our hearts, for love is the only thing that expresses the gratitude one feels under such circumstances. We went aboard the steamer at 4 o'clock and enjoyed every moment while crossing the Atlantic. Gaylord asked me several times to relate with full details all the experiences we had passed through, and after each story, his only comment was, "How marvelous! How wonderful!" On our arrival in New York, Rayburn met us at the pier, and I never saw a happier man. When he was introduced to Arthur Livingston as Bob's uncle, he was delighted indeed. We went directly to Washington, D.C., where the Livingstons were to establish their new home. Thus does the Great White Brotherhood ever continue to bless humanity in this marvelous, silent manner, and through its unconquerable power and intelligence, forever fulfill the law of the eternal. The light of God never fails.